going to open up for session one on building trust and managing risk. So this, we really want to frame a shared understanding of vaccine hesitancy going forward, as this is the sort of pinpoint to all the discussions going forward. So we want to ensure that we all have a shared, we've changed the Russian one slightly. There's one. Could you go one forward? So we want to understand what your understanding of vaccine hesitancy is. It'd be great if anyone wants to volunteer their understanding of what they think vaccine hesitancy is. Anyone have a brave soul to start us off? Louise? Yes. Can we get a microphone for you?
Thank you very much. Vaccine hesitancy is like a behavior to delay in accepting the vaccine or rejecting the vaccine totally due to maybe issues, some factors, like a confidence factor, it could be maybe conveniency or maybe complexity. Thank you very much.
That's great.
Thank you.
Does anyone else have a different understanding or anything to add to that? You talked about delaying, refusing, and about confidence in vaccines as well.
Maybe I'd just make a comment. I very much agree with what our colleague just said, but I thought I'd make a comment around the nature of how vaccine hesitancy can kind of show itself in both what I would say more formal and informal ways. So it can be quite subtle, like a group of new moms talking about delaying immunizations or expressing worry about the immunization schedule or the safety of the vaccines themselves. Or it can be quite formal, where people are actively trying to convince others. So I've seen it manifest in a number of different ways, but I see there as being kind of a continuum of hesitancy where the views are expressed with varying degrees of strength.
That's great. Anyone else want to add to that? I think you made an important point that it's a continuum, that there's, you know, full refusal and full acceptance, but hesitancy kind of is in that sort of, you know, they're not sure, or they're delaying, or they're may comply with some recommended schedules, or some vaccines, but not all vaccines, have minor concerns, like you said. So there's a whole range of hesitancy within the complete refusal and absolute acceptance. So that was a very good point to add. Thank you. Does anyone have anything in terms of your country experience to add some sort of contextual bits around that, if there's, you know, hesitancy in Armenia that's, you know, specific to just HPV, or, you know, is it vaccine specific, or is it broadly, or is it, if anyone else has any sort of...
In Armenia, total overall coverage, routine immunization coverage is very high. And we don't have any problem with any vaccine. Even in the world, you know, measles, anti-measles campaign is going, and there is a measles resurgence. In Armenia, measles and rubella are eliminated, and two doses of vaccine coverage is very high, 98, 97, it depends on years. But for HPV, specifically for HPV, we had a problem. Before introduction in 2017, in December, we had a big challenge in the country facing with a huge problem, a lot of anti-vaccination campaign, movement. It was really terrible, and we were not expecting that this vaccine, HPV vaccine, will be have a lot of rumors, a lot of challenges, misinformation, very huge social media activity, publicity in the country. A lot of terrible videos were circulating in the country, in social media, in schools, even in school sharing within parents, terrible videos, terrible messages saying that this vaccine is causing infertility, menopauses, paralysis, a lot of things. Although we did a lot of preparatory activities in the country, trainings, national conferences, a lot of awareness campaign, but to be honest, this anti-vaccination campaign is well organized. And we didn't expect that even they could enter into schools and have a lot of discussions with parents. So how the country was managed these rumors? It was really very difficult work because there was an atmosphere of scare, fears with the parents, and we couldn't convince parents to vaccinate their girls. To manage this situation, we started to analyze the situation, find gaps, and draft a very detailed plan how to act, how to manage this situation. First of all, we found out that our problem is going from healthcare providers, from frontline medical doctors, because they personally they didn't have trust to that vaccine. How we found out, we analyzed this situation, the vaccination performance, and saw that we had doctors who had 100% coverage, but along with these doctors, a lot of medical staff who didn't believe to that vaccine, and they didn't have any vaccinated girl within the catchment area. That is why we decided our work will be, first of all, targeted these medical doctors, frontline medical doctors, and started countrywide, the second phase, countrywide educational program. Training program for all doctors. It doesn't matter. This medical staff is involved in immunization activities or not, because the big problem was coming from gynecologists, from neonatologists, from those doctors who is not involved in immunization activity, but they have trust to population and they can advise vaccinate to girls or not. So the first program was training, then consultation meetings, a lot of consultation meetings, personal, individual-based. Our staff was going to polyclinics, to health facilities, and talking with personal medical staff, with nurses, with pediatricians, general practitioners, trying to find out what is the frequently asked questions and how to address that questions. And second activity, I would say country very big decision by Minister of Health expand vaccination age because we found that if we have a lot of vaccines in the country, it will help for medical doctors to trust that vaccine. And expanded actually the vaccination age to 45. It doesn't matter for women or for men. Everyone who wanted to be vaccinated, be allowed to medical workers to vaccinate, just to have a lot of vaccine in numbers, just to regain the trust to that vaccine. Believe me, that strategy was helped, that worked, and starting the second attitude focus we give, we started to convince pediatricians it's okay, vaccinate all who wants, but the first focus will be routine vaccination, 14 years of old. And now we have at least 20% of coverage. After introduction, it was just 5%. Now we have 20% of coverage. And our purpose, our goal is to increase this coverage at least next year before April to 30%. At this moment, in the country, we are conducting a very wide, nationwide HPV vaccination campaign, awareness campaign. This is actually the first stage we entered. That is from Armenian experience. I forgot to say that another strategy, we called all Armenian doctors from USA, from UK, from Australia, from Lebanon, from Russian Federation, to join their efforts to help Armenia to overcome this problem. And we organized very big congress in Armenia in July, in the first week of July, Armenian, called Pan-Armenian Doctors Congress. And there was a big panel discussion on HPV. And after that, we have short videos from well-known Armenians, and broadcasting all this video of, in social media, in TV. Even these days, we are using these videos. So that is from Armenian experience.
Thank you so much. That's fantastic. So I think you highlighted that vaccine hesitancy was particularly among the HPV vaccine and then among healthcare providers and how you've done that. So that's a really great example of how it's context and country specific and how sometimes vaccine specific. Thank you. So just briefly, I'm gonna give you the a little background on vaccine hesitancy. In 2013, the WHO Strategic Advisory Group of Experts, or SAGE, convened a working group to define and understand the reasons for vaccine hesitancy. So again, recognizing it as an emerging challenge and issue. In 2015, they concluded that vaccine hesitancy refers to delay in acceptance or refusal of vaccination despite availability of vaccination services. Vaccine hesitancy is complex and context-specific, varying across time, place, and vaccines. It is influenced by factors such as complacency, convenience, and confidence. Is that a shared understanding of vaccine hesitancy broadly? Is that a good framework going forward, or does anyone have any problems with that definition or want to add anything else? Yes, please, Shireen.
On. Yeah, I guess I'm just missing, I know this is a definition that everybody works with, but the service delivery component that is so iterative as an influencer on hesitancy, I'm just missing that a little bit in the complacency, convenience. I know convenience is a little bit there, but there's other issues, I think, of service delivery.
Yeah, okay. And do you mean in terms of where they receive vaccines and the confidence of the staff and the, like, what specifically about service delivery?
It could be a range of things, yeah. ranging from obviously the convenience factor, so how easy is it for them to get access, not just to the health service, but also the particular vaccine.
Yeah.
But also how are they treated, what are the right. waiting times, how are people communicating with them, how do they feel, is it child-friendly? So, you know,
absolutely.
It's such a big range.
Yeah. yeah, no, that's a very important point and kind of feeds into healthcare provider as well, but that's a great, can add that to our working definition and shared understanding of vaccine hesitancy.
Thank you very much. I thought that what she just added was included in convenience. In the convenience yeah. sector where they look at accessibility
sure.
and factors attached to accessibility, including mm-hmm. service delivery, and who is actually offering the service.
Mm.
I think it should be part of convenience. I don't know if we want to bring it out, but we'll have a look at it. Thank you very much. Jen.
Thank you. Oh, yeah, go ahead, Lisa.
Thank you. So specifically on that point, I would like to add and just refine that possibly. And also just to provide some background on where WHO currently is in relation to our assessment of the current evidence base that supports informs discussions and recommendations by SAGE. So we've recently been doing a lot of work to look at the latest evidence that has been emerging since SAGE developed this definition. And that has enabled us to start to do some initial work on refining our thinking and understanding of a concept like hesitancy. So we have seen the literature and the evidence evolve quite significantly in recent years. And this means we haven't yet gone back to SAGE, but we're planning to do that next year, I hope, to update these definitions and the conceptualization of what is hesitancy, okay? What that means and what we see in the latest evidence is that hesitancy is much more related to motivations and intentions, okay? It's someone who's possibly just undecided. They're on the fence. They don't really know. And they're not perhaps entirely convinced, but it's about their intention in relation to, you know, possibly having some knowledge, some, you know, values or underlying beliefs that are also supportive of vaccination. But their motivations and intentions do not take them all the way through to being able to seek or demand vaccination. So in that sense, in relation to what's here, we see hesitancy being much more related to, say, confidence or complacency, right? But the convenience factor in relation to service quality or access or convenience, that's separate. And we keep that separate to our understanding of what is hesitancy. So for us, for example, if someone is not able to access service, okay, if it's not easily available or convenient, or in fact, if they have a really bad experience when they are interacting with the service providers, that is not a hesitancy issue. That is separate to hesitancy, okay? Because that's just a matter of services being perhaps badly designed, okay? And not adequately designed to meet the needs of those communities and parents. So that's separate to hesitancy. So that's where I would perhaps recommend putting aside some of these convenience factors which are less related to people's motivations and intentions, okay? Mm. So that's just to update you on the latest thinking WHO, which we will be taking to SAGE as soon as we can. We are in discussions about when we do that. But also just to speak for the latest evidence that has emerged in the last few years since SAGE carried out this work. Thank you very much.
Fantastic. Thank you. That's an important point. And I like how you talked about, you know, the motivation and intentions. That's a very good point. And as we're going through the workshop, we're going to, you know, come back to this over and over again, but just to kind of frame the initial conversation. Just wanting to note, again, that in 2019, WHO named vaccine hesitancy as one of the top 10 threats to global health. So this is huge and very relevant and a timely, I think, discussion as well. So, hopefully we can, you know, work to address this in our own context. I'm going to hand it over to Susan now. Thank you.
Hi there. Okay, so I suddenly realize now the slides are behind me, so I just have to... Can I actually have a mic just so I can... Great. Sorry. This is great. Right. So, as you say, I've been working at the Gavi Secretariat, but I'm part of a very much larger alliance, the Vaccine Alliance group, that's made up of the core partners of WHO, UNICEF, CDC, JSI, all the major players in immunization. And so the work that I'm presenting here is a lot of the discussion that's been happening over the last couple of years. This is very much an interactive session, so at any point, just raise your hand and add to the discussion. If you have something that you want to share, please go ahead. And I'm going to talk a bit more broadly about building trust in immunization. Okay, next slide. Yes, so can we have the next slide? Oh, sorry. This one. Yeah. I have to multitask. Yeah. Sorry about that. I'm not very good at multitasking. So this is what the new demand hub looks like. And you'll see here the core partners on the left, but we have a growing group of expanded, but what we call expanded partners. So that's people who work in the immunization space. But one really important group that's not on this slide, and we must put it on the slide, is that we're really here for countries. And we just, a few months ago, in Kathmandu, I think about 2 months ago, we had a fantastic workshop that was the first one where the demand hub was really able to be with. We had six countries from Asia, and we met and we had a fantastic week together where we were really able to look at all the, bring all the different levels, the global, the regional, and very much the country. And the countries led that discussion, and it was very much that the partners were there in support. So it was a very exciting meeting. And I think everybody really enjoyed some of the cutting-edge ideas and new approaches to these really growing area of work. And you'll see here the kind of where we see that the hub can add value in having advocacy and communication materials, setting agendas, being part of the global discussions. We've managed to influence Gavi 5.0, and we're in the process, we hope, this group who are passionate about demand are starting to influence the immunization agenda 2030 as well. But we really want to have this dialogue with countries, and understanding your needs better, we can actually design a support network that really helps all of us understand the complexity of the issues that we're facing in the hesitancy and confidence space. So how do we demand? How do we define demand generation? And we've settled on this as a simple definition, that it's the action of creating demand ensures that parents, caregivers, communities, and influencers value immunization. That they, and it's a kind of intangible word, put great store and value and will go to some effort to secure it for their child. That they trust that it's safe and that it works. Very, very important for any parent to make an effort to come forward for a vaccine. That they're confident not only in the vaccine, but they're confident also in the service, in the provider, and also really important, and some of the countries in this room have wrestled with this, that there's high levels of confidence in the authority that's mandating them to have that vaccine. And that on a practical level, that they have all the information, the capacity, the motivation, and the tools to seek out immunization on time. Because as we know, it's a very individualized event. It's not like a polio campaign where everyone is vaccinated on the same day. It's really about understanding the right time to come forward with a particular child to a particular place to a, for a particular vaccine and to go around that loop several times. So you can see that from the point of view of being a communicator, it's actually a very challenging exercise to get everyone on the planet doing this behavior at the right time. So as I say, that's our working definition. Now, just to try and, it was a very complicated thing, and when we were working at the Secretariat, we were trying to explain this issue because in Gavi, I think I'm not breaking any confidences if I say that Gavi as an alliance has been really focused on supply for the last two decades. And there was a prevailing theory that if you just made services available, then people would come. But actually, in a number of places, we discovered that actually wasn't the case. For example, in northern Nigeria, they put a huge amount of effort in building routine immunization services. In particular states where there had been no quality services, a huge effort, but coverage actually barely rose. And that was partly because they hadn't put enough thought into actually actively encouraging people to come forward. Why would they come forward if services hadn't been there for a very long time? Why would they suddenly believe that services were there? So just to look at this diagram, and this is the most simplest, and Lisa pointed to the very exciting work that's going on to understand this in more detail. So this is like a demand generation for dummies kind of slides here that really sort of, what was our simplest way of approaching this? So the first thing is, why do we miss children? It's amazing, but nobody until recently was actually asking that very, very simple question. It's a great question. Why do we miss children? And we discovered that when we do surveys, whatever methodology we use, there's still a certain percentage saying we didn't know about it. More commonly, it's not necessarily they've never heard about immunization. More commonly, it's about that very specific knowledge. I didn't know when I was supposed to come or what I was supposed to come for or where I was supposed to go on what day, etc. So even when we have quite sophisticated programs, we need to understand that that very simplest of practical information is really important. The second big bucket is around trust, as we've heard. And there's a whole spectrum of trust issues from the most practical thing of the side effects. And I lived in Vietnam for 4 years and was working with my colleagues here. Delighted to see them here today. But one of the challenges in Vietnam is that in a rapidly urbanizing population, it's difficult for parents to get to those facilities and many of them, they cannot afford to lose a day's work because they're on informal. They have informal contracts. They work in the market. They can't take time off work. So that whole business of being afraid that my child might be sick tomorrow and I don't have anyone to care for them was a deterrent. That's the most practical of trust issues, but those underlying issues that we're seeing in many countries, where it is about that, you know, we've seen this in Shireen, who's sitting there, has worked extensively in polio, and I think polio has learned a huge amount of trust. And I remember working with Shireen, and we kept coming back to this, and we kept saying, it's all about trust. And when, in fact, people thought it was all about kind of practical things. And so we've done a lot of work together to kind of unpack that and try to understand it in a more deep way. So if you know about it, if you trust it, then there's still this step somehow, what we call bridging the intention to action gap, which is, you know, I was sitting with the Joint Secretary, and she wouldn't mind me telling you the story, but the Joint Secretary in India, and I was sitting with her, and she says, you know what? She says, I'm passionate about vaccines. I'm responsible for the immunization program, but I still myself forgot to take my daughter to get her HPV. And she said, you know, it's just like everyday life gets in the way. And so there's a whole area of reasons why we don't move forward. Sorry, I've lost my. Sorry, I don't have the password, sorry. There's a whole lot of reasons as to why we don't actually get to the facility on time. But as Lisa was saying, there's a lot going on in the mind around that, in terms of that intention to act and the motivation to act. The last bucket is that what we're now calling commonly service experience, that even if you did make the journey, you see the mum and the baby there at the bottom, and walking towards, it could be a dad, by the way, and we need many more dads going to immunization, but walking towards the facility, that point of actually getting there, that's not even enough, because when you open that door to the facility, is someone polite to you? Are they welcoming? Can they speak your language? Are you asked to queue? Maybe you have a toddler, and maybe you're pregnant with your next child, and you need a toilet, but there's no toilet in the facility. These are all reasons where service experience can actually be a major, major barrier. And getting around this through that experience to the point where, was that a good experience, that so good that I actually want to come back for the next vaccine? And we also have a simple problem that sometimes health workers don't make it clear when they need to come back. And a mother that's not confident and doesn't have that information available may fall down at that step. So one of the challenges, I actually did have a slide which I haven't put in this deck, but I should have done. We've started to look at what available data there is to try and see where the breakdown, it's roughly 30% that we found are not still knowledge and attitude gaps. Another 20% or so in the trust area, and it can be higher in some countries, and about 10 to 15% in the intention to act, with the remainder being on the service side. That's the sort of rough ballpark that we've worked in. But what I do want to say is this is the problem, that even though we have some data, it really isn't very robust. It really isn't very reliable, and it's certainly not standardized across countries. So it's a major, major problem. And I'm delighted to say that Lisa is here. Lisa's leading a work called the Behavioral and Social Drivers for Immunization. It's really key work to unpack all of these issues and also start putting in measures so that we can actually be able to measure and understand all the things in the range as we see. Vaccine hesitancy is part of what we need to look at, but we need to look at the whole range of issues in demand generation. So I think this is important. I don't know, will we have time for Lisa to talk a bit, or should we ask Lisa to speak a bit now? Do you want to say just a bit more about that? We can. I don't need to put you on the spot. We can. Okay. But I do want to, Lisa's not allowed to leave this room until she has shared all the important things about this really critical work. Okay, so I think that, you know, that first kind of introduction part, I would love us to spend a few minutes really looking at and discussing, and maybe we have a little bit of conversation in the group, and then we open it up for people to feedback. And so we want you to think about this critical point where you've gone into the facility and you're out there, you go in and you sit with the provider. What are the challenges that face clinicians and others when they communicate and have that interaction with parents? So I'd love us to spend just 10 minutes now having that discussion at your table, and then we'll open up and see what people want to say. Okay. You can discuss.
I was gonna see if I could change my setting. It's a very quick lock setting.
Oh, right. Yeah, just keep, like, doing that. Yeah, sorry, I will. Sorry about that.
If it gets too annoying, my phone.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's fine. Okay, folks. Okay, so who wants to tell me what the key point that came out of their table was? Okay, lots of hands going up. It was great to hear the discussion. There's a lot of buzz going on. Great, so please share.
So, in Armenia, first of all, we have a lot of communication, lack of communication skills. Clinicians, medical doctors, they don't know how to communicate with parents on vaccine benefits, on risks and benefits on a vaccine, what are the disease risks and what are the vaccine risks. And also, they don't have. We have a lack of time. They don't have much time to speak with parents, to talk with parents, and to address all questions, parents' questions. Another challenge I would mention is lack of knowledge, and mostly they don't have. enough knowledge to address all questions what parents raise during the vaccination. They think that if parents they bring their children to a health facility, that means parents are agree with vaccination, and that's enough. They don't have to speak with parents. That's all from
that's
my
great.
Side.
That's great. No, that's really, really helpful. Because these are some of the challenges. Are people at the other table, is that a similar discussion that you had? Yeah, please.
Yes, I agree with the colleagues, the first table. The challenges the health worker is not the provide enough the information to the parent. The first thing I think we have to introduce for the EPI schedule first for the parents, let them know, because sometimes the parents understood I already take the baby, got the vaccine like a first dose. They think it is not for them because they don't know about the EPI schedule, how the, for example, some vaccine, you get the three dose enough for, but they don't understand. And when they have to bring the baby back again to the health facility or in the fixed site or hourly services, this for the program from the health worker have to do first for the provide information. The second for the parents and the community also understand for the EPI schedule also, and sometimes we have the for almost the 40% the mother no school, like not enter the school, the limits of the language space. So for the any group, they don't understand like allow language if we provide information space. So now for the mother, limits of the language, only the husband know well because they not go out at the village. That's the program for the language also. And community, we have to provide the information. For example, we have to like IPC training to the village community to understand about the vaccine hesitancy first.
That's such an important point. And those of you, there's a number of countries in this room who have language challenges, although there may be a majority language that the vast majority or would speak, but actually many of the mums have not been educated in that language. I know that Vietnam and Laos actually share some of those challenges around your cross-border areas. And I think in Ghana, how many languages do you have in Ghana?
Uncountable.
So that's where obviously this challenge where, you know, as communicators, we often think, well, we used to think 20 years ago that the answer to everything was a poster and a slogan on a T-shirt or a cap, but clearly it's not, and there is no real quick fix. The complexity of the discussion that has to happen in not just the main language of a country, but actually translated into all these different dialects is a very, very complex process of what we have to, when you're discussing issues like trust, that, you know, it's hard to find the language for that, particularly if you're bringing science, which may not be the paradigm in which the community that you're speaking to understands the world. And, you know, the question is, you know, who's right on this issue? The point is everyone's right, that actually we if we're going to communicate, we need to speak in ways that people really understand. So, yes.
I do agree with our colleague in the room, but I would like to add one more point. Like a health provider limited on communication skill. For example, when we provide so many vaccine for the children at the same time, but the skill to how to help provider provide to parents or caregiver is still limited, and they don't know how to explain, make parents understand of vaccination benefit. Then most of parents refuse to get so many shots for their child. Even medical people also not confident to get a mini shot.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, I don't want to cut off any really important conversation that happened on these tables, but I do want to just move to this next section. There will be a chance to come back to you, to your issue. Sorry, can we go to the next slide? It just makes me think. I just want to say that for the last 20 years, probably, we have focused on communication. Communication is clearly important, and you're going to spend time over the next 2 days talking about that communication in more detail. But I just want to skip, because I have to say, we've shuffled our slides a bit, and I'm having to cope with the fact that, because our colleague Sam went sick, her mother went sick, so she's not here with us today. But I just saw what the next slide was, and I thought it was a very nice segue to what we were just discussing, because we've been thinking about it purely as a communication issue. Somehow, if we tell people the right thing to do, they will do it. But I think we're now at a very important point in time where we realize that it's not just about communication, but it's just as much about understanding people's behavior and then working with that understanding to be much more, I wouldn't want to say manipulative, but much more deliberate about how we bring behaviors to pass. So it's about taking off your IEC hat, if you're old enough like me to have that be like a very important description, IEC. We all did IEC. Now we're starting to do something really exciting called behavioral interventions, which behavioral insights, you might have heard behavioral economics. These are all new and exciting terms. And what I want to point to here is a very exciting slide, because it talks about what we call the caregiver journey. And it's about that journey that mum and hopefully dad, because we really want to be working on those dads, are going to make together with their newborn around this ellipsis here. And you'll see here that number one, sorry it's not big enough, but it would be great actually if we can get printouts of these and give these to people, because I think this slide is really important. But we start out with the knowledge and awareness and belief. That's number one. So I know about it. I am aware of it. I'm aware of when, where, how to get it. And I believe that it's really, really good. And you'll see some of these circles. They talk here about you need to have practical knowledge. You need to, it needs to be confirmed. So that's, you know, that it's constantly repeated, so it's confirmed that it's good. We need to understand that people, they focus on the most pressing challenge, so it needs to be relevant. It needs to be really front of mind. We go around this circle to the next. We've got some in these boxes, these circles, you see things like friendly reminders. I get an SMS that says, hey, go to the clinic. It's your child's immunization today. And we come around this, and that social pressure, that if you're part of a group of mums that had babies together, you might hear one mum saying, hey, have you had your Penta 1 yet? And they might say, well, no, I haven't. Is it time? Yes, it's time. So that kind of conversation that happens. And then we go around till we get to the intention part. So we need to make sure that people are really, I intend to go, and this is basically confirmed by the social norm that we've just talked about, and that they feel empowered. I'm going to take my child to vaccination, and I'm going to feel really good, because it's a very positive act to take, and I know that I'm protecting my child. We come around the circle, and we get to areas like preparation, cost, and effort. So, you know, do I know where to go? How to get there? Do I need a bus?
Do I need to know the timetable? All of these things, we come round to actually reaching the clinic. We got off the bus, got baby and toddler and all of that. We go to the clinic. Do I feel welcome here? Do I feel that I belong? And, you know, you start into the experience that you don't have to wait so long in a queue. It's nice and efficient. You go in, you have your vaccination, and then you have that conversation that we've just talked about. And that we have a good experience, and they vaccinate, and they reassure you. They tell you that the child may be a little bit out of sorts, a little bit not feeling so well, maybe a slight fever, but don't worry, you can take paracetamol, etc. You guide them through all of that before they leave. They feel confident. They feel that they actually are looking forward to that next appointment. Now, I think this has really changed all of our thinking about the work in this area. And actually, a part of what Lisa's doing is really unpacking all of these different stages on this journey and actually starting to unpack them both in terms of the practical knowledge, et cetera, but also the behaviors and what's the psychology behind actually activating someone around the circle. So we're very excited about this work. I think just want to say that we can actually start putting this as a tool into practice, and we're starting to use it in the field to have a discussion about where does it go wrong? Does it go wrong at the information side? Does it go wrong in terms of the practicality around the access, etc.? Does it go wrong when they come to the clinic and the experience of care? And it's nice to see that actually different countries and even within countries are starting to generate their own very localized caregiver journey map. And you'll see here, this is actually a human-centered design exercise where you'll see that in Zimbabwe, when they did the exercise, that the problems were more on the kind of knowledge and intent side and not so much on the point of service. But at the point of service, I've seen South Sudan, for example, that it was all about the access to the services and et cetera. So it would be fun to see you actually trying this in your own countries and seeing where you land. This I want to link back to. This is another tool. That was a very participatory, very simple tool that UNICEF has around human-centered design. I'm moving to a slightly more, not more complex, I think just more scientifically based, slightly. It's more about really understanding those behavioral drivers. The TIP 2.0 tool that we're extremely excited about, and Lisa will talk about, this is where a very systematic approach to diagnosing where these breakdowns are in the program. And these two tools were developed slightly on separate paths, but we're actually now bringing these tools together. And I think what you're going to see in the TIP HCD 3.0 hopefully will be a really practical, doable, feasible set of tools. The point I want to make here is that we're looking more broadly at demand and not just narrowly on hesitancy. And I think some of us in the room feel very strongly that if you just go down the hesitancy path, you kind of end up with a bit of a bias, and that you end up not, you know, it's like, do you use the carrot or the stick? You know, do we have enough of positive? To me, the best vaccination against hesitancy is to have a really strong demand generation program that is putting value on vaccines and the importance of it. So we do encourage you to have a look at these tools, both the HCD toolkit, which is very much a sort of very practical, very simple to use, and can be done at facility and house and even household level with groups of caregivers. But this is the TIP 2.0 has been developed a little bit more as a diagnostic for an immunization program to go in and start looking at where the challenges are. Getting back to you, as I say, we did get our slides out of order, and I really apologize for that. But this is really pointing to that last discussion that you had. There is a new set of global interpersonal communication tools that... there's a website, you'll see it there. You can go on there. There's tools available. I think it's 4 languages. We definitely have Russian. We have English, Spanish, I think,
is it in Portuguese and Russian? Hmm? Sorry, yes, English, French, Spanish, and Russian. And more language will come soon. But you'll see a wide range of tools. There's videos that can be adapted. There's reference cards, FAQs. The FAQs are really useful. I've used them already in the office, frankly. It's a very multi-purpose tool. But you can download, and that initiative will grow. So the more that you do it in your countries, we'll be able to get them up there. Now, we've just got a little bit of a little bit of a stop for a bit more discussion, and I think we'll come back to these tables. But we really want you to think about, in terms of the immunization space, who is it that's driving conversations? So we've talked about the caregiver, but who else is important in your immunization ecosystem that's influencing and having bearing on that, making sure that that caregiver journey happens? So we just want you to have 5-10 minutes talking about that. I think what we'll find is culturally we'll probably have some differences in the answers to this question. So it would be really good to get a spread of ideas as to who is driving it. Okay, there we go.
Okie dokie. I made it work. Okay, yeah, it's fine. Great, okay. Okay, so who did you come up with who was driving discussion about immunization? in your countries? So who wants to, maybe somebody from this side of the room. Who's driving that discussion?
We discussed that the majority of the influence. Who are the third influence? So the majority of decisions are taken by the mother and mother-in-law in Uzbekistan. So the mother-in-law is a huge influencer in our country and probably in the region as well. So if the mother-in-law says you have to go and vaccinate your kids, then it's done. You know, if she's against, then it's a huge challenge, and then a whole community has to work to convince her that it should be done. But also, we have a lot of structures in our society. I'm not sure how to translate them in English. We have what we call mahallas, and it's like, what is it? Like a local community, yeah, we have leadership within each community, mahalla committees. And so these play a big role because generally the Ministry of Health works with this committee on the national level and then down to local level. So basically all information on introduction of new vaccines, like with the HPV, you know, it's done through these mahallas, and it's very effective. Basically, on the community level, if the mahalla committee says that this is important and this is what you have to do, people listen and they work well with the mahallas. Then we have women's committee, which focuses specifically on women's issues, health, etc. And so they also play a very big role, both on the national and down to the local community levels. Then we have a new structure called Family Scientific Something Center, and it also, they basically do sociological research, but also they conduct trainings and informing the society. So right now with the HPV vaccine, we have tried to involve them in spreading awareness among communities. So these are several structures that are very effective, and we're working together with them. At the same time, a lot of influence in terms of the capital city is done by bloggers, by local influencers on the social media, some of whom don't really have professional knowledge, especially medical knowledge. But also engaging those is very helpful in our intervention. So we have had some really good experience with them, and we can share more if interesting. Yeah.
That's great. So what you're saying there is that you do have strong structures if they are activated correctly, but you're also pointing to this phenomenon of new, I wouldn't necessarily say structure, but new reality, that these uncontrolled conversations. I just want to hand over to your colleagues behind you, who also, they mentioned mahallas, but they also mentioned their mums groups. And how much do you think your mums groups, you were quite honest about that, are driving the conversation? And it's Georgia, isn't it?
Yes, as I mentioned, in social media, this big mums group share some negative messages, but as I mentioned in our discussion, in Georgia, our mothers and parents must trust to their doctors if doctors have evidence-based information, and they convinced mothers to do vaccination, so they do this, and there was no problems for that. But we have some popular doctors, some names, The mothers are trust more. So we think the doctors and nurses are the main persons for parents to trust to vaccinate their children.
Now that's great, because you're talking about the need to get ahead of the conversation, to be proactive, to use your resources, your frontline workers, to actually influence and stop this uncontrolled discussion and make it into a more controlled discussion. Mm-hmm. For the other countries, who has something that's different to what we've heard so far? Who has a different type of influencer that's driving the discussion in your country? Yeah, Ghana.
Yeah, in Ghana, religious leaders are so important. The imam, the pastors. At times, we have also influence from the homeopaths, the healers at the community level, who need to survive or strive, destroy the modern medicine in favor of their own medicine. So they are also there. Apart from that, I think everything is mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
They are also blockers. Social media is having a lot of influence right now on the behavior of people and acceptability of vaccination. So that one also is coming up. Now, the normal media, journalists, when not informed properly, or when not involved properly, they can go ahead and negatively influence any immunization program, including new vaccines, especially, and actually create mediocrity in the implementation of the program. That one too is there.
Okay.
One last thing. There's something that I don't know where it belongs. Sometimes we do a kind of integrated service, and people hardly differentiate, for example, mass drug administration and vaccination. So they've confused the two. And so recently in Ghana, there were media reports about people having received vaccination in schools and collapsing. Meanwhile, it wasn't vaccination. It was actually some adverse events from mild drug administration. And so that presents a communication challenge. But it's the same ministry that is doing it. So you don't go saying it is not vaccine, but this one. Because in that case, you're also destroying it if you don't take time. So I don't know where that belongs, but it's also an issue.
Well, you're talking really about this very much organized and clarified communication and the importance of people when they're doing communication planning to understand the impact of what they're doing, not just on their program, but another program. And particularly if it's the same ministry, people need to be talking to each other. But I think that's important that basically the public sees the whole picture and not just what we want to tell them. So important. Okay.
Vietnam had a really interesting distinction of different influencers at different points in time, sort of along the journey, which I thought was a little bit different.
So just with your regard, because in the rural area, so most of important... So in the rural area, so most important influence is often the nurse or doctor or the leader of the village. They can provide provide the advice to the parent, and also the mother will bring the child to the community to the vaccination posh. But anyway, for the in the urban area where the mother most access the information from the network, and so many people they live in the very close high building, so it's so difficult to the healthcare worker they accept the mother to give the advice or information. So right now we expect to accept those mother go through the different channel. As you know that the very young children is often they go to hospital for treatment. And of course, those children is often they delay vaccination because of their health status. And so we want to use the that channel, because when the child gets the dizzy, so most influence is the doctor and nurse. They give, by that time when they give the advice, mother really appreciate that. And so next year under the Gavi support, we will implement the new approach for fully vaccination, go through the hospital-based facility to motivate the doctor and nurse to give the advice to the patient, to the mother, so, and provide the vaccination for the children they get, they hope hospitalized, and also for the children, the vulnerable children with the chronic disease, it's often was rejected by the community health center because they so fear about the give vaccine to those children.
Mm.
So that's the new approach we intend to plan next year. And we discuss with the our team and the CAPI and also other.
That's great to hear about this new, Shereen.
I just wanted to add an important point to that is that the Vietnam team was mentioning that when the child is healthy, the most important influencer is the family. When the child is sick, the most important influencer is the doctor. And I think this sort of gets to a lot of countries' challenges in that the doctor or the healthcare worker is usually confronted after there's a problem. And so they're automatically oftentimes put on the defensive. And this becomes a really big challenge. And how do you communicate when there's already a problem? And how can we change that dynamic so that doctors are actually on the front foot instead of the back foot?
Yeah, I think that's such an important point. And I think it speaks to some of the conversations that you had here, that how do we control the discussion in a proactive and positive way? How do we understand the social networks that operate in our country and how one influencer needs to work with another type of influencer to really have a whole ecosystem that is protective and promoting immunization? I just want to move to the next slide. And this is just a slide that captures where some of the things have really gone wrong in the last couple of years, things that we've learned from massively, I think, in terms of understanding. And there's actually a slide here. The light-colored countries are the countries that have the highest number of under-immunized children. And you'll see... you'll see that here, and these are not the countries that are in the room, but what you will see is how in these countries with large numbers of under-immunized children that that we've had some major trust events, loss of trust. And you'll see here at the beginning of 2017, for example, India, which has one of the strongest immunization programs in the world, and it's actually a huge population, and they do extremely well. But they actually introduced an MR campaign, and one of the things they didn't necessarily take into account was these social networks and the influencers. And what happened in the beginning, they were actually bringing in a vaccine, the MR vaccine, and one of the influencer groups that they didn't consider before they did this was actually the private practitioners. And the private practitioners made money because the government gave measles vaccine, and then many parents would go and buy MMR in the private sector because they knew that that was great for their kids. So when the government introduced MR vaccine, some of the private practitioners were concerned that they would lose their income because it was about 2,500 rupees consultation for this private vaccine. And one of the challenges it set up was a tension not just with the private practitioners but private schools. And they hadn't done the orientation. They hadn't got them on board as champions. And there was a lot of pushback. And at the time, also, rumors that were spreading in some other what we call kind of almost like the polio populations about fear about vaccine, somehow these rumors that were spreading in different groups actually cross-contaminated, and we had a bit of a perfect storm at the beginning of the campaign. What they learned from that was the need to really get influencers on board. And so subsequent phases,
They still had some problems, but the problems were much less and they lasted less time, simply because they had learnt from how and who to be engaging proactively. So it was a very important lesson, and that lesson was shared with other countries. Another one in 2018, the following year, we had problems with a campaign in Nigeria, also around measles, and there was rumors spread, and that one was because there were lots of rumors circulating in the population. The timing of the measles kind of came at a time where it was very easily politicized, and there were rumors about monkeypox, etc. And so that one, it was put under control, but it needed a lot more active engagement with key influencers. And Indonesia has become a bit of a famous example where their first phase went really well, but the second phase, which was in the lead up to the presidential campaign, and in the, not the majority island, but all of the islands around the central island of Java, and they didn't do enough orientation with the religious groups. Ghana talked about that too. The problem was that not only was it politicized, but there were also some concerns that they hadn't done the conversations and they hadn't got an agreement from the Ulama Council on terms of the halal status of the vaccine. And so coverage became a major problem, and a one-month campaign became a six-month campaign, and even at the end of that, they only reached 70%. So you can see the importance of us understanding our local social networks and really being on the ball for that. Now, so another one that some of you have mentioned, and we had some mention of traditional media, we had some discussion in the Vietnam group about media, and I think we really want to turn to that. It's interesting how it's, you know, it used to be that traditional media was the only way to go, but now, of course, we're seeing this spread of social media. We need to get them on board, and we also need to be thinking about these influencers in terms of the social movement. I love that term, the super spreader. Have you, I mean, obviously a super spreader has a particular epidemiological connotation, but I love it if we're going to use it in terms of spreading enthusiasm about vaccines, that actually this is potentially a great way for us to do. And what we want to be doing in this room is creating this social movement. Just to show you what's coming down the line, we're going to return to the media question in a minute, but we're starting to realize that our traditional ways of doing communication are no longer enough, and that we're going to need to get a bit more creative, because those of you who've been battling with the mums in the mums group, or those of you who are starting to see all of these creative videos and things that are coming up, we're having to do... there is a video, and when you get this presentation in your resources, I'm not going to show it today, but have a look at the video. It's just basically inviting you. We are creating this community, which we'd love to make you part of, that is going to start creating ideas. And you'll see that we've managed to create a platform, and we're just about to launch our second challenge soon. But 120 people from around the world who've actually been sharing ideas around how to get sticky and catchy and viral about vaccines. And you'll see here, like, using computer games to teach kids about immunology. How do you become trendy? Changing the conversations. All of these things that we need to be doing. And hopefully you'll have some creative ideas in the next 2 days. We want you to think in this session, not just about traditional media. We want you to think in this discussion about how do you use all of the tools that are available to you in terms of creating that excitement around immunization, getting ahead of the conversation as we discussed here. Not just using the traditional structures, but also trying to use some of the more social structures and ways of communicating. How do you create this excitement around immunization? So we'd love to hear you talk about some of your traditional ideas or things that you have been doing, but also just to stretch you in this last discussion, we've got another 10 minutes here. Have some of you talk about what you think you ought to be doing, or when you walk out of this workshop that you will start thinking about doing. Who has the most creative idea? We'll give you a prize for the person that can come up with something from everything that we've talked about so far in this session that you think could be a new and exciting way to talk about vaccines. Okay, go. Thank you.
Yes, I understand. But it's really an important issue because the issue then,
I'm going to be here.
Okay, folks. I know you know it. Because you notice I hate having my phone. Okay, everybody. We're roughly 5 minutes before lunch. And is lunch next? Yep. And it's actually difficult to break up the discussions because I think we're having such great discussions. You will have seen that the session this morning is a little bit to set up the whole workshop, that some of the themes that we've touched on you will be returning to in more detail in the different sessions. Just because we have a couple of minutes left, were there any, who had the most creative ideas in terms of that discussion? Who wants to volunteer anything that came out of your discussion that was a little bit new or different? Who wants? Ghana? Are you kidding? You want to try something? Please go ahead. Go ahead. Can't wait for this.
Okay. Yeah. So at the national level, we have what you call a communication group, where every journal, actually the media group, we have the media group heavily represented at the at the national level. So when there are issues, already it is captured at the national level, understood, analyzed, everything is they actually interpret it very well, so that it can go down to the other journalists, media group, and to the masses in the community. Yeah. That one is there. We have the alert system. For instance, when there are issues going on, for instance, Ghana, Togo, Benin, Nigeria, they're in the same belt. So when there's an outbreak in Nigeria, for instance, the public health unit at the national level will capture it quickly and send it to the regional level, region will send it to the district level, and the solutions, what they have to do, is also attached so that people will start putting in place preventive measures.
Okay.
Now, what we have the airtime. We are trying to create a airtime at the regional level with those media. Mm. We create airtime, and every week, health promotion unit officers will be going to the radio station to talk about vaccine preventable diseases and the solution to that, so that the masses are aware. When we decide to do maybe routinely or introducing new vaccine routinely, it will not be too much of a surprise.
Okay.
Now, when there is an emergency situation, since this structure is already in place, it will be used to handle emergency issues as well, so that the information can go down. These are the things we think we can do.
Okay, so you're talking about creating a much more systematic approach,
yeah,
making sure that the conversation is happening.
Thank you.
So I can see when you have an emergency that you're gonna communicate that information fast.
Fast.
How are you going to keep the interest level when you don't have emergency news? So did you talk about that? How are you going to... Because one of the problems of immunization is it's very dull, because when it works, it's barely noticed. So how are you going to make talking about routine immunization really sticky and interesting?
The masses must be aware of what is going on the ground. Information must be given to them about what is happening at the regional district level.
Okay.
They should know the target population, the audiences the results, so that they will know the position. For instance, if there are about 20 districts in a particular region, what is happening? Which district is taking the lead? Which district is last? All the time, it's like we create a competition sort of thing.
Okay.
And that competition will not be created only,
okay,
in the domain of those at the receiving end for the vaccine. But those who are promoting, also we can create some competition for the journalists.
Yeah.
Also, for them, those who are involved in promoting the immunization services can also come on board. The competition can also be created in the area of hospitals. Hospital, the clinicians who are involved also come. If, for instance, we have the airtime, if we are not going to talk about, we can see opportunity to talk about other medical matters.
Mm.
To make things interesting, we can even talk about nutrition.
Yeah.
To make this interesting for people.
Okay.
You understand? If you are talking, you have airtime to talk about HPV.
Yeah.
Well, I want to talk about oncology in general.
Yeah.
Okay? We can also see opportunity to talk about the role of good nutrition with refer to oncology, and talking about vaccination with regard to oncology, so that when the HPV vaccine is introduced, it is not a surprise for people.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
So you're talking about making the information relevant. I love your idea about competition. We've always talked about the idea of areas competing on coverage rates and really getting that sense of pushing up, et cetera, having a conversation.
And then an issue also, feedback.
Yeah, feedback.
Feedback.
So that feedback loop about performance is always really encouraging.
Thank
so
you.
I like that.
Thank
and
you.
And I would love you also, when you're talking about
if we're going to introduce HPV, for example, what about bringing that story of someone who's had cervical cancer and can talk about the impact on their life so that when the vaccine comes in, people feel that it's powerful and relevant?
The issue of creating champions, champions that will go around is also something that we have to consider.
Super spreaders.
Yes.
Everyone in this room is now
a super spreader. Thank you very much.
A super spreader for when you go back into real life. So good. Okay. Anyone else got a burning creative idea? Oh, Vietnam.
Thank you. I would like to explain about our experience about the media play in Vietnam, because as you know, Vietnam, we have to say we suffer with the immunization safety and AEFI. Previous time, right after the death case occur, after vaccination, right after many, many messages on many, many journal shows about the death case and they thinking about the vaccine and vaccine safety. And after that, at least for 5 years recently, we conduct many training course. I have to say training course for the journalists. We select about 50 or 60 key person from famous journal to attend the workshop and the training course about 2 days or 1 day. We explain about the immunization safety, and we also training for them about the causality of AEFI, but very, very simple information, not so difficult as for the health worker, general information. And after that, they understand step by step, and now when the serious AEFI occurs, they still give us a message on the journal, but the detailed information very, very more specific and exactly. And the second, we have to say that we have to closely working with the journalists when adverse event occurs. After conduct the causality assessment, we call them and organize one meeting and inform them about the causal, the final result of causality assessment. And I think sometimes very quick response, only the AEFI occurs, the death case occur only 1 day or 2 days after, we have to we have to inform the first message. It means at that time, sometimes not so the final causality, but we have to say that not for the vaccine and immunization practice is good. So other causalities been considered, and after the have a final result, we have to inform to them, and they show the message on the mass media and not influenced to the vaccination and EBI. And sometimes we invite them to work with us to make the question and answer in some social mass, social network. And for example, mother and father network, for example. And we can easier and closer to answer and to understand what the mother and grandparents thinking about the vaccine and immunization safety. And we think that in the future we continue maintain this activity. And I think it's very important. Journalists understand about the vaccine and immunization safety. They support us. And if not, they not understand clearly. Maybe it's a many, many rumor after that. Okay, thank you very much.
No, that's great, because that actually, the experience of Vietnam in terms of having a whole cluster and series of clusters of AFI over a number of years, I think dating back to about 2010, even it's as far back as that, that I think you have a lot to share in this workshop, and it is probably a very good case study for the learning network generally on systematic rebuilding of trust through working with media.
Yes.
So very, very good.
Yeah.
And okay, so I think we're kind of at lunchtime. There was a lovely discussion going on the Lao table about
a very different approach, which was from in terms of engaging media, but actually engaging at community level, this participatory learning in action. And I really encourage you to share that example more widely in the next 2 days. If you just want to say a word now, if you, because it was a very creative piece of work, but it's taking a very different approach in a setting where media is not the dominant factor, but you found your own way of making media, if you like.
Yeah, and thank you. I would like to share for the BVCon PLA participatory learning action from the community. We conduct maybe more than almost 10 years. Because last time we tried to improve in the community participatory for the vaccination. PLA, we did in the community group discussion with the mother. Group mother, group father, and group community leader. We try to get the information from the community, what happened for the EPI, what they need to, what the issue or challenges for the village, for the EPI. The first thing, they don't know about the information immunization. They know for the HIV or malaria or something. Why? Because they said the information is not reached in their community. They said the health worker, when they come to the village, they are not get the information before, the health worker not send the information before they come to the village to provide the vaccination, and after that the group discussion what benefits of the vaccine, and they more understand and what they want to improve in for the immunization services, and they feedback to the health worker also when the health worker come. They have to inform them before, at least 3 days before they come to provide the immunization services, and they have to feedback the health worker to provide the benefits of the vaccine and also including the side effect, what if happen, and they have to consider to whom. If the baby something happened to get the AUI, they have to go where, how. This is the information related. And also we have to provide information to the, in each group, the parents for the father, father group, they almost allow Hmong community, who make the decision is the husband of like a father-in-law, mother-in-law, who make the decision to accept the baby to get the vaccination. We try to discuss with the group father and group leader also different, because we cannot group work together. If group work together like a father and mother, the mother no idea to give feedback because they think the husband, if the husband said, they cannot tell anything. Yeah.
Yeah. What's really interesting about that example, which you can talk about and share, is that actually was an example of a bottom-up developed campaign. So we were talking there about talking from the media, from the national level, but this is a wonderful example of how actually the work at the community level infused and actually designed something that was then taken up nationally. Clearly, there's a need to kind of refresh that now because you're still having problems. But I do think that listening and all of that you've just told us about is that your efforts were completely informed by the conversations that were happening at the village level, and you replicated that in many, many more areas. So I think that's very exciting work. Okay, I think that's us for the session. Thank you very much. It's been really engaging and really enjoyable. And do you want to?
Sure. Hi, I'm Heidi Larson. Happy to be here, and sorry about our delay. We've got travel on both ends here. And my colleague, Pauline.
Hi, Pauline Patterson. Hi, nice to meet you.
Okay, thanks, everybody. I have two announcements.